The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from a double issue, the May 31st, June 7th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. And as such, we will try to do more of the newsy current stuff first week and then get to some of the other items next week. But as usual, we're looking at the cover drawing. It shows National Security Advisor John Bolton. He is sitting at, looks like a game table. The board looks like a map of the Middle East, and with Iran highlighted across the table from him as one of the Iranian mullahs. And Mr. Bolton has all his game pieces look like airplanes, and he's pushing them all in on Iran. And the title is Bolton's War Game. Could the administration's threats to attack Iran spark a military confrontation? And we will start with that as our first main story. U.S. sends mixed messages on Iran threat. What happened? President Trump threatened to wipe Iran from the map this week, only to swiftly dial down his rhetoric the next day by saying he'd be happy to negotiate with the Islamic Republic. Fears of a U.S.-Iran clash have intensified in recent weeks after Trump's National Security Advisor, John Bolton, a longtime proponent of regime change in Tehran, announced that the U.S. was sending an aircraft carrier and bombers to the region following reports that Iran or its proxies were preparing to target American forces. After a rocket launched by a suspected Iran-backed militia landed within a mile of the U.S. embassy in Baghdad this week, Trump tweeted, "If Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran." A day later, the president softened his stance. "If they called," he said of Iran's leaders, "we would certainly negotiate." Administration officials say they want Iran to end its support for terrorism and abandon its nuclear program. Iran had curtailed its nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief as part of an international deal signed in 2015. Trump withdrew the U.S. from the pact last year. Iran announced this week that it had quadrupled its production of low-enriched uranium, which is suitable for power plants but not for nuclear weapons. By raising production, Iran could soon exceed the stockpile limit on enriched uranium set by the 2015 accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said his country would not cave in to U.S. threats. "Iranians have stood tall for a millennia while aggressors all gone," he tweeted. "Try respect. It works." What the editorial said: "If war breaks out, it'll be Bolton who's to blame," said USA Today. Trump was elected in part because of his promise to end America's endless wars. Yet he seems to have been talked into a maximum pressure campaign of ever tighter sanctions and increasingly bellicose threats by Bolton, who has made a career out of advocating force against Iran. With U.S. naval battle groups and Iranian gunboats eyeing each other warily in the Persian Gulf, Trump should be aware that one wrong move could ignite a regional conflagration. "If you want to blame anyone for the soaring tensions, blame the state sponsors of terrorism in Iran," said the Wall Street Journal. Rather than spend the money it harvested from sanctions relief to help its own citizens, Tehran used that cash to sponsor Houthi militants in Yemen, the murderous Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and the terrorist militias of Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. Trump and Bolton's goal isn't to start a war. It's to force Iran to stop spreading chaos and behave like a normal country. What the columnist said. You know we're in trouble when Trump looks like the adult in the White House, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. Bolton's solution for every international crisis, North Korea's nukes, Nicolas Maduro's autocratic regime in Venezuela, and now Iranian belligerence in the Middle East, is U.S. military action. Thankfully, Trump has overruled his warmongering advisor every time. But all those collisions raise a question. Why does Bolton still have his job? Bolton has far more clarity and intelligence than his critics, said Hugh Hewitt in the Washington Post. He recognizes that Iran will remain a rogue state so long as it's ruled by theocrats bent on the destruction of Israel and the triumph of its Shiite ideology over Sunni Islam. Of course, Bolton isn't going to persuade Trump to launch a full-scale invasion, given the president's disdain for nation-building projects. But Trump might put the mullahs in their place with a limited show of force, as he did with the two strikes he ordered on Assad's genocidal regime. There's no such thing as a limited strike on Iran, said Max Boot in the Post. The country has highly advanced Russian-supplied air defenses that could cause a greater loss of pilots and aircraft than we have become accustomed to. And Tehran has spent decades planning how to hit back after a U.S. strike through swarms of drones and anti-ship cruise missiles, cyber attacks, and assaults by proxies on U.S. troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. Just like the Iraq Hawks in 2003, today's hardliners have no idea how such a fight would end. Far better not to risk starting one. And we'll read the second main story this week, titled, Impeachment Rumblings Grow Among Democrats. What happened? House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this week faced growing pressure from Democrats to begin impeachment proceedings against President Trump. With an angered Trump saying he would no longer attempt to work with the opposition party on any legislation. In a tense closed-door leadership meeting, Pelosi rejected calls for impeachment from Democrats, increasingly frustrated by the Trump administration's blanket refusal to honor congressional subpoenas. Democratic anger boiled over after the White House blocked former counsel Don McGahn from testifying before Congress about Trump's attempts to end or curtail special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, which Mueller listed among 10 possible acts of obstruction of justice. The White House is also refusing to turn over Trump's tax returns, despite a law requiring the Treasury Department to do so upon a request from Congress. I think we're at an inflection point, said Representative Ted Lieu of the House Judiciary Committee. If we can't get information, I think we have to start proceeding down this path. Pelosi accused Trump of conducting a cover-up by trying to hide information from congressional investigators. But the Speaker counseled fellow Democrats to have patience, saying the House still has many options for getting information the President wants to conceal. She pointed to a strongly worded ruling from a federal judge this week, ordering Trump's accounting firm to turn over financial documents to Congress. Pelosi's cover-up statement enraged Trump, who stormed out of a meeting on infrastructure with Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer after only 3 minutes. In a rambling Rose Garden speech after that meeting, Trump said he was done working with Democrats on infrastructure or any other issue unless they end the investigations into his administration. You can't do it under these circumstances, Trump said, so get these phony investigations over with. What the editorial said. It's understandable that Democrats are concerned that an impeachment fight could get in the way of their campaign to unseat Trump in 2020, said Christian Farias of the New York Times editorial board. But Mueller's report laid out clear evidence of grave misconduct by Trump, eagerly accepting campaign help from a foreign adversary and making multiple attempts to thwart the Russia investigation. Democrats have a constitutional duty to consider whether Trump has violated his oath of office. Democratic leaders know impeachment would be a disastrous waste of time, said the New York Post. But Pelosi and Nadler know that their Trump-hating base will never accept that. So they're doing their best to appease the impeach now wing of the party with pointless theatrics. The president has the right to frank, confidential discussions with his staff, so Democrats can't force McCain to testify. Nevertheless, Democrats are portraying the White House's inevitable use of executive privilege as a cover-up. It's all a show. What the columnist said. The Democratic leadership's reluctance to even utter impeachment is becoming untenable, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate. More than 900 federal prosecutors, including many Republicans, signed a letter stating that Trump would already be facing multiple felony charges if Justice Department rules didn't prevent sitting presidents from being indicted. With Trump's lawless and corrupt administration now rejecting any form of congressional oversight and threatening to investigate investigators, the president clearly believes himself all-powerful. Democrats will only cede even more power to him by declining to impose consequences. Political calculations should not take precedence over the rule of law. Relax, Democrats. Pelosi's strategy is working, said Rick Wilson in thedailybeast.com. The political momentum for impeachment is building, thanks to the House's efforts. This week, a federal court ruled that the House is entitled to Trump's financial records held by an accounting firm. Trump's taxes, which he clearly sees as his political kryptonite, could be next. Trump's foot stamping on McGahn and Mueller also ensures that if and when the Democrats do compel them to testify, it will be must-see television. For now, the smart play remains the same. Impeachment in all but name. Sorry, but anyone hoping for Watergate 2.0 is likely to be disappointed, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. The revelations about Nixon's crimes started small and gradually got bigger and bigger. Trump's transgressions were almost immediately overhyped as hard evidence of an active conspiracy with a foreign power. But in the Mueller report, they've mostly been downgraded to obstruction of justice. Will that capture the public's imagination? Just ask the Republicans who futilely impeached Bill Clinton. Don't be so sure impeachment will backfire this time, said Aaron Blake, also in the Post. Clinton's scandal was fairly simple. He engaged in an affair, lied about it, and covered it up. Trump's obstruction, however, pertained to grave matters of national security and election integrity. If his outrageous behavior is detailed in television hearings, it could shift public opinion. Nobody should over-extrapolate the lessons of 1988-99 onto 2019. And before we move on, we'll read one of the It Wasn't All Bad pieces. Robert F. Smith was delivering the commencement address to the graduating class at the historically black Morehouse College in Atlanta when the billionaire investor made a surprise announcement. He would be paying off the student loans of the nearly 400 graduating students. "This is my class," said Smith, who is the richest black person in America, "and I know my class will pay this forward." The gift, which is expected to run into tens of millions of dollars, was greeted with a standing ovation and chants of MVP. Elijah Dormius, a 22-year-old business administration major with $90,000 in debt, was ecstatic. "If I could do a backflip," he said, "I would." The controversy of the week is titled, SATs. Will adversity scores make them fairer? On a scale of 1 to 100, how much adversity have you faced? Asked Jane Hu in Slate.com. That may seem like a hard question to answer, but the College Board, the company behind the SAT, formerly known as the Scholastic Aptitude Test, now believes it has a formula for measuring a student's environmental context. The exact algorithm for determining the score is proprietary information, but it involves 31 variables in three distinct areas: school, neighborhood, and family life. Starting this fall, college admissions officials, if they choose, can weigh both the applicant's SAT results and the amount of adversity they faced. The goal is to address what College Board CEO David Coleman calls the disparities in wealth in the SAT and to level the playing field for students from struggling neighborhoods and schools who aren't likely to have the tutoring, SAT prep, hands-on parental support, and other advantages of well-off kids. Yale University has been testing the adversity score, said Michael Neitzel in Forbes.com, and likes the results. The percentage of low-income and first-generation students in its freshman class has almost doubled to 20%. But will the adversity score really level the playing field for college applicants? Or will it backfire, adding to American skepticism about the fairness of college admissions? The elephant in the room here is race, said David Clegg in NationalReview.com. Colleges know the Supreme Court may soon ban any consideration of race in college admissions. Thus, the adversity score serves as a proxy for race, to let colleges keep discriminating against upper-middle-class whites and Asians. Although the score doesn't look at race itself, the variable it does consider, such as crime rates and property values in an applicant's neighborhood, are clearly chosen to boost the admissions odds of black and brown applicants. The score shares affirmative action's fatal flaws, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. It will undermine one of the last objective measures of academic merit to make it possible for disadvantaged students to get into colleges where many of them struggle academically. The deeper problem, said Carol Markowitz in the New York Post, is that the adversity score is such a crude tool for measuring what a student has overcome. What about the student who lives in a great neighborhood and goes to a great school, but goes home to an alcoholic father who beats him? What if a kid is persistently bullied at school for being overweight or short? The adversity score has a noble goal and an appealing premise, said Sidney Fussell in The Atlantic. But adversity isn't quantitative. It's qualitative. Whatever formula the College Board uses to measure it will be inherently subjective. So do we ignore a student's background altogether? Asked Nicholas Dirks in Barron's.com. The SAT supposedly was designed as an egalitarian objective means to measure a student's innate academic potential. But wealthy parents and profit-seeking tutors have engineered it into a tool for the reproduction of privilege rather than its eradication. And privilege in America remains inextricably entangled with race and ethnicity, said Jeff Yang in CNN.com. Recent research has found that even black males raised in wealthy families in well-to-do neighborhoods are more likely to become poor in adulthood than to stay wealthy. Pretending that the many forms of discrimination still faced by black and brown students can be measured by a bloodless adversity score is a heartbreaking act of surrender to the claim that race no longer matters. Let's see what's in our good week, bad week segment. Seems that it was a good week for substitutions. After a customer at Britain's upscale Hawksmoor Manchester restaurant ordered a bottle of fine French wine worth $333 and was instead served a $5,760 bottle of Chateau Le Pin Pomerol by a rushed employee. There was no extra charge. It was a good week for literature, with the news that Donald Trump Jr. has signed a deal to write a book about his views on politics and his father. Trump Jr. is reportedly also mulling a run for mayor of New York City. And it was a good week for Roger Stone, still awaiting trial in the Russia probe, after a court granted him permission to judge the 2019 Exotic Dancer Invitationals at the Pony, a strip club in Memphis. The former Trump advisor, who has portrayed himself in the past as a libertine and swinger, needs to raise cash for his legal defense. But it was a bad week for icons, with the death at age 7 of Grumpy Cat, the internet superstar. Grumpy, who died of a urinary tract infection, was a cherished member of the family, said her owners, who can continue to cherish the estimated $100 million that Grumpy's image has earned. It was a bad week for wild and crazy guys after former Saturday Night Live star Dan Aykroyd said he's seen UFOs and is sure that aliens are visiting the planet. The proof is going to start dribbling out, said Aykroyd. And finally, it was a bad week for even wilder and crazier guys after police arrested more than 125 people when drunken anarchy broke out at the Go Topless Galveston Jeep 4x4 event in Texas. Police said there were car crashes, people being run over, and dozens of group brawls, and that it was lucky no one died. And before we move on, we'll read this short piece, Trump Cashes In on D.C. Hotel. President Trump reported earning $435 million in 2018, including $40.8 million from the Trump International Hotel, just blocks from the White House, according to his financial disclosure form. The annual self-reported filings are notoriously vague, made worse by Trump's conflating his business's revenue with his personal income. His biggest moneymaker last year was the Trump National Doral Golf Course in Florida, generating $75.9 million, while Mar-a-Lago took in $22.7 million. His Washington hotel is often patronized by foreign diplomats and corporate officials seeking to curry favor with Trump. Several lawsuits charge that Trump taking their money violates the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which prohibits gifts or payments from foreign states. Since we are in one of our double issues of the year, we'll pick up a few of the items from the U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance features, starting with the U.S. at a glance. Sacramento, rail tie-up. California sued the Trump administration this week for canceling a $929 million grant for the state's beleaguered high-speed rail project, calling the move retaliation for California's opposition to a border wall. The Federal Railroad Administration announced last week that it would revoke the grant because California's bullet train is way behind schedule and over budget. A line linking Los Angeles, San Francisco, and the Central Valley is now projected to cost $77 billion and to be finished by 2033. California, which has already spent $2.5 billion in federal funds on the project, outlined a sequence of events in February. After California joined 15 states suing to invalidate Trump's emergency declaration at the border, Trump tweeted that California has wasted billions of dollars on their out-of-control fast train. Hours later, the Railroad Administration announced its intent to terminate the grant. Tucson, border slurs. a Border Patrol agent called migrants, quote, mindless murdering savages, and other slurs before allegedly hitting one with his truck, court records revealed this week. Matthew Bowen has been charged with using his government-issued Ford F-150 to knock down a Guatemalan man suspected of jumping the border fence in December 2017. And prosecutors offered dozens of text messages as evidence of Bowen's violent attitude toward migrants. 2 weeks before the incident, Bowen called migrants disgusting, subhuman, blank, unworthy of being kindling for a fire. When an agent asked if Bowen used peanut oil while tasing for a frying effect, Bowen replied, "Gnats are best made crispy with olive oil from their native país, the Spanish word for country." His attorney says the sentiments are part of the agency's culture. Other texts describe Bowen's frustration with the failed agency, wishing Trump would please let us take the gloves off. Columbus, Ohio, an open secret. An independent report published this week found that Ohio State University team doctor Richard Strauss sexually abused at least 177 men between 1979 and 1996. It concluded that more than 50 athletic department staffers, including two athletic directors, were aware of Strauss's actions but did nothing to stop him. Strauss, who killed himself in 2005, was the team physician for several men's sports. The greatest number of victims, 48, were on the wrestling team. He required students to undergo needless genital examinations while routinely showering with players and loitering in their locker rooms. Former students said Strauss's actions were an open secret on campus. Yet a 1994 investigation by Ohio State sports medicine director John Lombardo said the accusations amounted to unfounded rumors. Strauss was finally removed from his post in 1996, but remained a professor emeritus at the time of his death. Jacksonville, Florida. Suspicious transfers. Multiple overseas transactions in 2016 and 2017 involving companies controlled by President Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner set off alarms at Deutsche Bank, the New York Times reported this week. Florida-based money laundering specialist prepared suspicious activity reports for the Treasury Department. But executives at Deutsche, which has reportedly loaned Trump more than $2.5 billion, decided against filing a report. The nature of the transfers is not clear, but a series of them in summer 2016, after Trump had taken office, involved Kushner's real estate company and Russian individuals. Tammy McFadden, since fired from the German bank, concluded that a report was merited, partly because regulators had already reprimanded Deutsche for laundering billions for Russians. Trump and his family sued the bank in April to block it from complying with congressional subpoenas. Congressional Democrats insisted Treasury officials act on the Times report. And now we have the world at a glance. We'll start in Kiev, Ukraine, cleaning house. Just minutes after Volodymyr Zelensky was sworn in as Ukraine's president this week, the former comic actor dissolved the parliament, part of an all-out effort to purge the government of those loyal to former President Petro Poroshenko. Zelensky, who won 73% of the vote last month, hopes new elections will bring his supporters into the legislature so he can deliver on his pledge to end corruption and secure a ceasefire in the war against Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Zelensky also called for the dismissal of Prosecutor General Yuri Lutsenko, who has ties to President Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani and who is allegedly involved in a plot to accuse Ukrainian officials of meddling in the 2016 U.S. election in favor of the Clinton campaign. Managua, Nicaragua. American killed in prison. A U.S. citizen who was arrested for taking part in mass protests against the authoritarian government of Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega was shot dead in prison last week. U.S. Navy veteran Eddie Montez Praslin, 56, permanently settled in his native Nicaragua in 2006 and was arrested on charges of terrorism and aggravated robbery last year after joining the demonstrations. A crackdown on protesters by authorities left more than 300 people dead and caused some 50,000 to flee the country. The Sandinista government said Montes Preslin, whom fellow inmates called Pastor because he led religious services, was killed when he and other prisoners rushed at guards. An attorney who represents detained protesters said Montes Preslin was shot in the back and not during a fight. Taos Island, Venezuela. Starving kids. As Venezuela descends further into deprivation, more and more children are dying of malnutrition. With inflation at more than 1,000,000%, most families can't afford to buy meat, and they resort to eating cow's hooves and offal when they can get it. The child mortality rate has increased 140% since 2008. After the New York Times published a photo last week of an emaciated 2-year-old girl on Taos Island whose mother couldn't take her to the mainland for treatment, Fabiola Molero, a Venezuelan nurse with the Catholic charity Caritas, hitchhiked 20 miles to supply the child with food and medicine. She said the child's neighbors gathered around to ask her for food, too. "We're working by the strength of our nails here," Molero said. "We barely have any resources." Mount Everest, Nepal. Everest is easy. A Nepalese Sherpa this week reached the summit of Mount Everest for a record 24th time, his second successful ascent in the space of 6 days. Kamirita Sherpa, 49, works as a guide for tourists trying to prove themselves on the world's highest peak and first scaled the 29,029-foot mountain in 1994. Sherpa guides travel ahead of climbers and prepare ropes, anchors, and ladder bridges. Kamirita said he had known there was a record to be broken. He would have submitted many more times over his career. "I can climb for a few more years," he said. "I am healthy. I can keep going until I am 60 years old. With oxygen, it's no big deal." Taipei, Taiwan. Gay marriage legal. Taiwan has become the first country in Asia to legalize same-sex marriage. Hashtag love one. President Tsai Ing-wen tweeted after the law passed last week, "We took a big step toward true equality and made Taiwan a better country. The path was set in 2017 when the country's constitutional court struck down a law defining marriage as exclusively between a man and a woman and gave the legislature 2 years to draft new laws. Taiwan is an outlier in the region, and the annual Taipei Pride Parade draws LGBT revelers from across the continent, many of whom cannot come out in their home countries. But the legislature may be ahead of the people. In a non-binding referendum last year, voters chose overwhelmingly to not legalize gay marriage." Kampala, Uganda. American peddles snake oil. A New Jersey pastor has been accused of running a scheme to give industrial bleach to poor Ugandans as a miracle cure that he claims can combat everything from malaria to cancer and AIDS. Robert Baldwin, 52, set up a ministry called Global Healing to distribute the toxic liquid, which he calls MMS, or Miracle Mineral Solution, reports The Guardian from UK. He trained about 1,200 clerics to distribute the poisonous concoction to up to 50,000 Ugandans. Money for the church comes from online donations and from British investor Sam Little, who used to advertise himself as a psychic. Baldwin denied distributing bleach and said he is being demonized by people who don't understand natural healing therapies. The U.S. Embassy in Uganda tweeted that it condemns the distribution of the substances, of this substance, which is extremely dangerous and not a cure for any disease. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll catch a few this week and then circle back to a few more next week. Starting with a breakdown in our democracy. Even if a Democrat wins the 2020 presidential election, progressive activists are bound to be disappointed, said Philip Klein. Our political system has fundamentally changed, and both Republicans and Democrats are now determined to obstruct every major policy initiative of the party in power. President Trump has been able to reverse some of President Obama's policies through unilateral action, but he has failed to pass legislation to overhaul immigration, build a wall, or repeal Obamacare. A Democrat who beats Trump will never be able to enact Medicare for All, a Green New Deal, or universal free child care, because these initiatives would die in the Senate, either by a straight vote or a filibuster. With a stalemate in Washington, the U.S. cannot address climate change, the national debt, gun violence, or any other major problem. Where does this lead? Americans may lose faith in democracy and support radical measures. Democrats are already talking about eliminating the Senate filibuster altogether and enlarging and packing the Supreme Court. In a second term, Trump might simply order his policies enacted and defy court orders to restrain him. No system of government has lasted forever, and ours may be headed for collapse. Barr concealed clear proof of obstruction. We now have a transcript that proves that President Trump committed obstruction of justice, said Jennifer Rubin. Federal Judge Emmett G. Sullivan last week ordered the government to publicly release a voicemail from Trump attorney John Dowd to the lawyer, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, asking if Flynn was going to turn over information that implicates the president. If so, Dowd said, then we've got a national security issue, so we need some kind of heads up. Dowd added that Trump still has feeling toward Flynn, a strong hint of a pardon. When Flynn's lawyer responded that his client was indeed cooperating with Special Counsel Robert Mueller, Dowd was indignant and warned that he would inform the president of Flynn's hostility toward him. This is clear witness tampering, the same kind that was included in the articles of impeachment drawn up against President Richard Nixon. To protect Trump, Attorney General William Barr redacted nearly all material about Flynn from the public version of the Mueller report. Barr's claim that Mueller found no obstruction lies in tatters, and with Sullivan now considering releasing more hidden evidence, including audio tapes, Trump could be facing real trouble. Most Israelis are not white Europeans. Despite what many leftists in the U.S. and Europe think, Israel isn't a country of privileged and powerful white Europeans, said Hen Mazig. The left often now frames the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in terms of race, portraying Israelis as white European Jews who fled Nazi oppression and who in turn became oppressors of people of color, the Palestinians. This intersectional narrative is often used to justify any and all attacks on Israel, but it is historically wrong. The majority of Israelis are like my family, Mitzrayim, of Middle Eastern and North African descent. For generations, Mitzrayim lived in the Middle East, but without sovereignty and equality. These Jews were persecuted in Muslim countries such as Iraq, where my grandfather was executed in 1951. When Israel was born, more than 850,000 Middle Eastern Jews sought refuge there. Like the Ashkenazic Jews from Europe who fled the Nazis, and the 200,000 Ethiopian Jews who came later, these new arrivals sacrificed all they had to build and defend the Jewish state in the land where our story started. Israel is not a colonial invader, but a place where an indigenous people have reclaimed their land and revived their ancient language. We'll spend a little time on the business page today. It's called The News at a Glance, starting with telecom. FCC blesses T-Mobile Sprint deal. The $26 billion merger of T-Mobile and Sprint cleared one of two key hurdles to approval this week, said Brent Kendall and Drew Fitzgerald in the Wall Street Journal. Federal Commission, Communications Commission Chairman Ajit Pai said he would back the deal between the third and fourth largest wireless providers in the U.S., swayed by commitments made by the two companies to advance two of the FCC's key objectives, bringing better broadband service to rural America and advancing 5G technology. But the FCC's blessings may not help with the Justice Department, which has the final say and is considering whether the merger would harm competition. A split may be forming between federal regulators, said David McCabe and Axios.com. The two agencies use different standards to decide on mergers. The FCC uses a squishier standard based on public interest, and T-Mobile has argued that its deal would help the U.S. compete with China in the race to 5G. The company hopes that will appeal to President Trump. Top executives have even been staying in Trump's hotel as they lobby for approval. But the DOJ focuses on the consumer, and critics say consolidation will result in higher prices and job cuts. The department sued to block AT&T's bid for T-Mobile in 2011. It could argue nothing has changed. Settling in for a war of attrition. Chinese President Xi Jinping said the nation is now embarking on a new long march and must start all over again, said Zhu Xin in the South China Morning Post. It was the most dramatic sign to date that Beijing has given up hope of reaching a trade deal with the United States. Xi did not specifically cite U.S. trade, but his remarks signal he is preparing the nation for the hardships of an extended trade war. State media outlets have adopted increasingly nationalistic tones in relation to the trade war since the U.S. raised tariffs. Equality. Rights groups target McDonald's. McDonald's faces 25 new sexual harassment complaints from workers, said Melina Ryzik in the New York Times. The cases filed this week, backed by the Times Up Legal Defense Fund, the American Civil Liberties Union, and a labor group, are a major test of the legal and labor power of the Me Too movement. The targeting of McDonald's by the public interest groups is strategic to spark reforms in the broader restaurant industry. Fast food chains have argued that they shouldn't be liable for the behavior of managers at franchisees' stores. Uber drivers go on strike for 2 minutes at a time. Frustrated Uber and Lyft drivers at Washington's Reagan National Airport have organized a simple way to cause artificial price surges, said Sam Sweeney in WJLA.com. Every night, several times a night, dozens of drivers gather in the airport parking lot and simultaneously turn off their rideshare apps for a minute or two to trick the app into thinking there are no drivers available. This creates a price surge, and the drivers turn the apps back on to lock in the higher fare. We work as a family, like a team together, one driver said. One person running the operation will monitor the rising prices in real time. The price increase typically ranges from $12 to $19 above the normal fare. Drivers say they are fighting back after 3 years of pay cuts, accusing the ride-sharing companies of raising fees so much that airport pickups are not worth it without pumping the surge up. We'll read two of the obituaries this week, starting with the conservative author who wrote historical epics, Herman Walk, 1915 to 2019. I'm not sure about that pronunciation. It's W-O-U-K. Herman Walk was happy to be known as America's greatest unfashionable novelist. While contemporaries such as Saul Bellow and Norman Mailer received praise for works that question American traditions, it was Walk who topped the bestseller list again and again with page-turners such as Marjorie Morningstar, 1955, and the World War II epic The Winds of War, 1971, later a hit TV miniseries. Walk's veneration of family, morality, and duty, an Orthodox Jew, he also wrote books on Judaism, earned him scorn from reviewers. "He can compete with the worst of television," one fumed. Walk was unperturbed by criticism. "Maybe it's because I don't see why a man can't write good books," he said in 1965, "and be a sane man at the same time." Walk, actually here pronounced woke, was born to Russian immigrant parents in New York City, said Guardian.com. After graduating from Columbia University, he wrote jokes and sketches for the radio comedian Fred Allen. Following Pearl Harbor, Woke served in the Pacific aboard destroyer Minesweepers, a life-changing experience. "The shallow conceit of a successful gag man faded away," he said. "When I came back, I wanted to write novels." He had his first success with 1951's Pulitzer Prize-winning The Caine Mutiny, a crackling drama on the high seas, said the New York Times. The novel sold more than 3 million copies in the U.S. and was made into an acclaimed 1954 movie with Humphrey Bogart. Woke never stopped writing. After publishing his 15th novel, The Lawgiver, in 2012, he immediately began work on his next book. "What am I going to do?" the 97-year-old said. "Sit around and wait a year?" The improv master who cracked up his co-stars. Tim Conway, 1933 to 2019. Tim Conway might have been TV's greatest goofball. The Emmy-winning comic actor was a hapless ensign opposite Ernest Borgnine's commanding officer in the 1960s sitcom McHale's Navy, and a core member of the Carol Burnett Show, a variety hour that ran on CBS from 1967 to 1978. A skilled slapstick performer and ad-libber, Conway delighted audiences with recurring characters such as the oldest man, who took an eternity to complete any action, including falling down the stairs. But Conway, who often veered wildly off script when the cameras were rolling, was best known for his ability to crack up his co-stars. In one famous sketch, he played a bumbling dentist who accidentally injects himself with Novocaine and slowly loses control of his limbs. His wild improvisations caused sketch partner Harvey Korman, his patient in the chair, to wet himself with laughter. "I'm very proud of that, too," Conway said, "because I owned a cleaner's at the time." Born in suburban Cleveland to a seamstress mother and an Irish immigrant father who trained horses, the young Conway struggled with dyslexia, said the Washington Post. School friends thought he was joking when he made mistakes while reading out loud. The book they were expendable, he recalled, I read as they were expandable. So he decided to pursue laughter for real. Conway studied speech and dramatics at Bowling Green State University and, after a stint in the Army, got a job at a Cleveland TV station, writing, directing, and occasionally performing characters for comedy spots on a show devoted to movies, said the New York Times. The skits won him an audition on ABC's The Steve Allen Show, on which he became a regular in 1960, kick-starting his small-screen career. Conway remained a comedy force after The Burnett Show, said The Hollywood Reporter. He struck gold in the 1980s with a direct-to-video series about a character named Dorf, a pint-sized sports enthusiast with a Scandinavian accent, whom Conway played by standing in a hole. In the 2000s, he found a new generation of fans voicing the character of Barnacle Boy in SpongeBob SquarePants and playing an out-of-touch former TV star on 30 Rock. Making people laugh, he said, was his role in life. I am not really qualified to do anything, he explained, but screw up. And we're on the Talking Points page. We'll start with the article, Abortion. Will the Alabama law backfire? Alabama's extreme new abortion law is the most damaging development to the pro-life movement in decades, said Jonathan Last in TheBulwark.com. Brimming with confidence that the Supreme Court's new solidly conservative majority is primed to overturn Roe v. Wade, Alabama legislators have passed a bill that bans abortion at every stage of pregnancy, with no exceptions for rape and incest. Doctors who participate in abortions could be sentenced to 99 years in prison. Planned Parenthood couldn't have designed a better weapon in their wildest dreams. Most Americans favor some restrictions on abortion, but only about 20% want to see abortion outlawed altogether. The idea of forcing 13-year-olds raped by their fathers to give birth is even more toxic. The Alabama bill will erode the steady ground pro-lifers have gained in recent years in changing public opinion. It will hang like an albatross around the necks of Republicans running for office while driving pro-choice fundraising and turnout. And for what? The law will be overturned in federal courts, and the Supreme Court will decline to reverse them, because supporting such an extreme, nakedly partisan piece of legislation would destroy what's left of the court's reputation. In the end, the Alabama bill will not prevent a single abortion. Alabama Republicans simply took the anti-abortion movement at its word, said Sarah Jones in NYMag.com. Abortion opponents may be divided on tactics, but they agree on the basic premise. Every abortion, at every stage, kills a person. If you really believe that abortion is child murder, it follows that rape survivors should be forced to carry their rapist baby to term. The Alabama bill should serve as a wake-up call for pro-choice, for the pro-choice movement. For decades, pro-choice women who've sounded the alarm about the steady, merciless, and punitive erosion of reproductive rights were dismissed as silly hysterics, said Rebecca Traister in the cut.com. Comparisons to The Handmaid's Tales were mocked. Now we see that our Republican adversaries intend reversing Roe v. Wade, asserting power over women's bodies and sex lives, and compelling us to give birth, no matter what the circumstances. It is terrifying, and the fight for our privacy and self-determination is going to last the rest of our lives. The government has a right and interest in protecting unborn children, said Georgie Borman and James Silverman in TheFederalist.com. Abortion is an act of murder that must be completely abolished, and for that reason, the Alabama bill doesn't go far enough. The law punishes doctors with up to 99 years in prison, but with no consequences for the mothers who seek out an abortion. This is misguided and deeply immoral. A growing number of women are ordering abortion medications online, and do-it-yourself abortions will become increasingly common if clinics are closed. The only way to reduce self-abortions is to impose homicide charges on any mother or father who participates in one. That kind of extremism only undermines the pro-life cause, said Ramesh Ponuru in NationalReview.com. I agree that abortion should ultimately be eradicated, but our moral obligation is to combat it as effectively and intelligently as we know how. The pro-life movement has made incredible strides over the past few decades by pursuing modest restrictions while also making the case for full protections for unborn children. Alienating half the country for the sake of moral purity risks all of that. We desperately need to have a more honest debate about abortion, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. President Trump and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy have already distanced themselves from the Alabama bill, saying there should be exceptions for rape and incest. Can they really think abortion is murder if they believe it's okay some of the time? Of course not. At the same time, pro-choicers should respect the belief of right-to-lifers that a fetus is not a mere clump of cells and that abortion is a matter of overwhelming moral importance. A healthier dialogue on abortion would recognize the ethical commitments of both sides. Most Americans stand in the muddled middle, said the New York Post in an editorial. They're repelled by the idea of a woman being sent to prison for a first trimester abortion and by requiring a teenage rape or incest victim to give birth. They also are repelled by abortions in the third trimester, which New York State recently made easier to get. Extreme laws in either direction will bring backlashes. Purists will never stop crusading for total victory, but compromise, even on so basic a question, is going to carry the day. We'll finish the show today with a quote from Doris Day, quoted in independent.co.uk, who says, "The really frightening thing about middle age is the knowledge that you'll grow out of it. Middle age is youth without levity and age without decay." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.